Let's turn then to Acts chapter 18, and we read the first 17 verses. This is Paul on his second missionary journey. He's been to Macedonia, and now has travelled down to Achaia, to Athens, and now to Corinth. So, Acts 18 from verse 1. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Clodius had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. Paul went to see them, and because he was a tent maker, as they were, he stayed and worked with them. Every Sabbath he reasoned in the synagogue, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Messiah. But when they opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent of it. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." Then Paul left the synagogue and went next door to the house of Titius Justus, a worshipper of God. Crispus, the synagogue leader, and his entire household believed in the Lord, and many of the Corinthians who heard Paul believed and were baptized. One night, the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision. "Do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one is going to attack and harm you, because I have many people in this city." So Paul stayed in Corinth for a year and a half, teaching them the word of God. While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews in Corinth made a united attack on Paul and brought him to the place of judgment. "This man," they charged, "is persuading the people to worship God in ways contrary to the law." Just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to them, "If you Jews are making a complaint about some misdemeanor or serious crime, it would be reasonable for me to listen to you. But since it involves questions about words and names and your own law, settle the matter yourselves. I will not be a judge of such things." So he drove them off. Then the crowd there turned on Sosthenes, the synagogue ruler, and beat him in front of the proconsul. And Gallio showed no concern whatever. It was with much trepidation that Paul made his way from Athens to Corinth, a journey of about 40 miles going west along the road from the great city of Athens to the even larger city of Corinth. He tells us in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 3 that he came to Corinth in weakness with great fear and trembling. You might think, well, surely Paul couldn't have felt like that. He must have been exaggerating. But then when we read this account here, we find that the Lord appears to Paul in a vision one night, and the Lord tells him not to be afraid and to go on speaking. The implication, of course, is that Paul was afraid, just as he tells us in 1 Corinthians 2, that he came in weakness with great fear and trembling. Now, there are several reasons as to why Paul might have felt like this. To start with, he was going to a very large city. Corinth was the third largest city in the Roman Empire, only smaller than Rome itself and Alexandria in Egypt. Corinth had been rebuilt by Julius Caesar some 100 years prior to this, and with its fine new buildings, it was an arrogant city. It was also a very wealthy city. It had two important ports. It's kind of located on an isthmus, if you remember your geography. And there were ports either side. It was kind of the gateway from one side of the Mediterranean to the next. And with that came huge amounts of wealth. Corinth was notorious as an immoral city. Apparently there were 1,000 cult prostitutes who operated in that city. Well, Paul approaches this city feeling his weakness. Not only has he been rejected in so many places, but as he approaches Corinth, it hardly promises to be any better, given the sort of city it was. And then, of course, there's a situation that Paul finds himself in. He's on his own. He's still waiting for Silas and Timothy to join him. And he feels that loneliness in his work. And once he does start to preach, sure enough, the opposition begins again. And so he comes to Corinth in weakness, with fear and great trembling. Perhaps you readily identify with Paul. Of course, all of our situations are very different to what Paul was facing. And yet we can be aware of our own weakness at times with such intensity. We can get discouraged as we serve the Lord. We can be afraid to witness for him. Perhaps the thought of even giving a carol service invitation to a colleague at work or a neighbour fills you with trepidation. Or we can feel that the demands made upon us are just too great for us, be it at work or at home or in church. And so easily, in our weakness, we can become filled with fear, just like Paul was here in Corinth. Have you come to church this morning weighed down with heavy burdens? Do you feel the weight of your responsibilities are too great to bear? Like Paul in Corinth, do you feel your weakness, even to the point of great fear and trembling? Well, let's see what God does for Paul in this situation. Let's see how God is able to encourage and strengthen us also as we consider this chapter. And I have three ways in which God encourages Paul. Firstly, God's encouragement comes through people. God's encouragement comes through people. Paul did not want to be on his own. Let us not think that he was some kind of lone. You cannot read the pages of the New Testament and get the impression of Paul as being a loner. Just think of all the greetings that he sends people. End of Romans 16. A whole list of people that he wants to greet. He's forever looking for people to join him on the team. The reason he's on his own here, if you remember back in chapter 17, verses 13 to 15, the Jews had come from Thessalonica to Berea, had stirred up the people against Paul, and so the Christians rushed Paul out of Berea and took him to the safety of Athens. And he leaves, instructing those who took him to tell Timothy and Silas to join him. Paul does not want to be on his own. And so in Athens, we're told he's waiting for Silas and Timothy. But they didn't arrive. And now he moves on from Athens and finds himself in Corinth. He's still on his own. Now, we all like company. Some of us like it more than others. You know, some of us do need a bit of space on our own at times. But we all like company. None of us would want to be on our own all day long. We feel that need for companionship. How true that is in our witness for the Lord. It was for good reason that Jesus sent out his disciples to go in pairs. I can remember hearing an open-air missioner describing how in his work of preaching in the open air, if he was on his own, he would have to walk up and down the street for half an hour, plucking up courage to stand and start preaching. And I felt for him. I could just imagine. I mean, we don't do a great deal of door knocking in Marston, but sometimes we do. It's so much better when there's someone else to do it with. I have to confess that there have been times when I've gone out to go door knocking and I've turned back home. I just couldn't face it. It's difficult when you're on your own. And Paul finds himself in Corinth on his own. But then we read in verse 2 that Paul met, or better, he found a Jew named Aquila. I'm not sure why the NIV translates it, verse 2 there. He met a Jew. It's the same word as is used back in chapter 17 about people finding God. There's something active about what Paul does here. He's on his own. He finds this man, Aquila. In God's providence, Aquila and his wife Priscilla had just recently arrived in Corinth from Italy. They'd come from Rome. All the Jews in Rome, we're told, had been expelled at the emperor's command. Claudius was the emperor. There is some historical evidence outside of the New Testament for this. Even the suggestion that it was over disturbances within the Jewish community over Christ himself, although that's not certain, and it doesn't say so in the New Testament here. Nonetheless, all the Jews had been commanded to leave Rome, and amongst them was Priscilla and Aquila. It seems that Priscilla and Aquila are already Christians, and they're also tent makers. And Paul was a tent maker. You might be surprised that Paul should have a manual trade. Apparently, rabbis were encouraged to do manual work in addition to their learning. And so Paul, who was a tent maker, agrees. He approaches them. Again, notice, he is taking the initiative. Because they were tent makers, verse 3, as they were, he stayed and worked with them. He went to see them. He approaches them. He's on his own. He takes the initiative to find companionship and partnership in the gospel. And it was agreed that Paul could stay with them and Paul could work with them as a tent maker. And this was the beginning of a long friendship and partnership in the gospel. You know, if we'd read on in chapter 18, we'd find that Priscilla and Aquila end up joining Paul on his team. And they go with him. Look at verse 18. Paul stayed on at Corinth for some time. Then he left the brothers and sisters, sailed for Syria, accompanied by Priscilla and Aquila. And we find that when they get to Ephesus, then Priscilla and Aquila stay in Ephesus. We often read of Priscilla and Aquila making use of their home. The church met there. Several times in Paul's letters, he mentions them. Of note, if you want to turn to it, Romans chapter 16 and verse 3. The first people that Paul greets in this long list in Romans 16 that I mentioned are Priscilla and Aquila. But notice how he refers to them. Greet Priscilla and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ Jesus. There they are, fellow workers, partnership in the gospel. They risked their lives for me. Not only I, but all the churches of the Gentiles are grateful to them. God had given to Paul these wonderful colleagues with whom they could work. Notice that the partnership was not one-sided. It wouldn't have been a partnership if it were one-sided. You see, in the end, Paul stays 18 months in Corinth. We're told that in verse 11. But it was not all at Priscilla and Aquila's expense, because Paul was willing to work with his hands, making tents with them. And he seems to have stopped doing that when Silas and Timothy arrive. In verse 5, when Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching. And kind of putting things together from other parts of the New Testament, it seems that when Silas and Timothy arrive, they bring with them a gift from the churches, possibly the churches in Macedonia. And let me just read to you 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 9, where Paul seems to be referring to this occasion. He says, when I was with you and needed something, I was not a burden to anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied what I needed. And that seems to refer to this occasion here when Silas and Timothy come from Macedonia and evidently they bring a gift with them. Paul no longer needs to support himself as a tent maker. He can give all his time to preaching the gospel. Now, we could say a lot about tent making at this point. Suffice it to say that possibly the majority of pastors in the world need to be tent makers, because most churches across the world, think of developing countries, simply can't afford to pay for a pastor full time. And this is the way it is. And it's wonderful when people are willing to work hard like that in order to be able to support a church and serve as pastor, missionary, evangelist, whatever it might be. But the point we're making this morning is the encouragement that Paul receives through people. Think of others in the scriptures who were an encouragement. Joshua was Moses' assistant. Joshua was with Moses. How that helped Moses. Think of Jonathan, a friend of David, who was with him in his trials and difficulties. Think of Elijah. He despairs of life. The burden is too great for him, and he asks that God would help, and God gives him Elisha. Men given by God to help share the load. And incidentally, all too often, they themselves in the process were prepared for future service. So Joshua becomes the next leader. Elisha becomes the next great prophet. Perhaps there's someone that you could seek out to help you. Just like Paul sought out Silas, and then Timothy, and here Priscilla and Aquila. Perhaps there's someone you could seek out. Or perhaps you could be that person, like Priscilla and Aquila, using your home. Next week, God willing, we'll see how they use their knowledge of the scriptures to further instruct Apollos in their home. Perhaps you could be that one who encourages the missionary, or the minister, or the evangelist, or the school's worker. You could be the one who is there as the colleague, asking how their ministry is going, saying, how can I pray for you this week? You can be that person. You might not be recognized by others, but God recognizes Priscilla and Aquila. They get frequent mention in the pages of the New Testament. We're never told that they were great evangelists or great preachers, but their influence for good was huge. Each one of us can be like that. God's encouragement so often comes through his people. Secondly, God's encouragement comes through his promises. You see, God sees the burdens that we bear. Our great high priest sympathizes with us in our weaknesses. He became human just as we are. He knows what it's like to be tempted the way you are being tempted. He knows what it's like to have the limitations of human frailty. And he sympathizes with us, we're told in the book of Hebrews. He knows exactly what we need to sustain us, and he knows exactly when we need it. And so, as well as giving to Paul these fellow workers, Priscilla and Aquila, the Lord does more, particularly when the opposition in Corinth begins to grow. You see, Paul started off just on the Sabbath day going to the synagogue and reasoning with the Jews. But now, with the arrival of Silas and Timothy, he's able to give all his time seeking to persuade them about Jesus as the Messiah. And some, we're told, believe, including none less than the leader of the synagogue, a chap called Crispus, who incidentally is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 1 as one of the people whom Paul baptized. But most of the Jews reject the message and indeed start to become abusive towards Paul, verse 6. But when they opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent of it. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." He goes to the Jew first, then to the Gentile, Romans 1. And as he turns his attention to the Gentiles, many of the Corinthians do believe and are baptized, verse 8. And yet Paul, it seems, is still fearful. Fearful that what has happened in place after place will happen again here in Corinth. Because all too often, particularly when he's left the Jews and gone to the Gentiles, the opposing Jews have rallied round and instigated opposition, sometimes in even neighbouring cities and towns. And Paul is afraid that the Jews are going to attack him again. And it's at this point that the Lord appears to him, or he speaks to him, in a vision. And he gives to Paul a message of encouragement for Paul just at that time. Verses 9 and 10. One night, the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision. Do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent, for I am with you. And no one is going to attack and harm you, because I have many people in this city." It's a wonderful promise. Here are promises specific to Paul in his situation in Corinth. Wonderful promises of safety and of success. I have many people in this city. Now, for us, the promises of God are perhaps more general. You know, God has not made us a promise that he has many people in Marston whom he's going to save. We have to take things more generally. We have promises like when Jesus said, "I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against her." Or we have promises like the vision that John has of glory, where there are people from every tongue, tribe and nation praising God. That's an encouragement to go out to reach new people groups with the gospel. You know that at least one of them is going to be converted and become a worshipper of Jesus Christ. But not sure we could call Marston a tribe. It's not guaranteed that anyone in Marston is going to bloom. Thank God some have, but we have more general promises that the church will grow, that the Lord will. We don't have a specific one like Paul does here for Corinth. But there is one of these promises that the Lord gives to Paul that is true for each of us in our work for the Lord. And that's the promise where the Lord Jesus says to Paul, "I am with you." You see, this promise is a promise that is given to all God's people. Hebrews 13 and verse 5 puts it like this: "Never will I leave you, nor will I forsake you." Quoting, incidentally, from the Old Testament, applying it to us today, applying it to all believers. Jesus himself, in the Great Commission, gave this promise. He said, "I am with you always, to the very end of the age." Clearly a promise that couldn't apply just to the apostles, because, well, they're long gone. And yet Jesus speaks of this promise as being to the end of the age. Here is a promise, then, that encourages God's people. Paul's response to this vision in the night was to stay. The very next thing we read in verse 11. "So Paul stayed in Corinth for a year and a half, teaching them the word of the Lord. He came with fear, feeling his weakness, with much trembling. But the Lord speaks to him, tells him he's with him, tells him he's not going to be harmed, tells him that he has many people in that city, and Paul stays. Priscilla and Aquila were a great help to Paul. But even the closest of fellow workers cannot always give you the support that you need. Even those who are closest to you do not always fully understand you and your needs. But the Lord does. And the Lord is always with you." Sometimes we need to learn how to draw strength from the Lord himself. David in 1 Samuel 30 was at a low point in his life. He was amongst the Philistines, away from the people of God. He was with a band of men who, well, had been faithful to him, but now as they return, they find Ziklag completely destroyed, their families taken captive, and David's men want to stone him to death. They're so bitter in their souls. And David is utterly distressed. I can't imagine any of us in quite such a bad position this morning. Let me know if you are. But we read that David found strength in God. At that point, when he was so low, he is on his own family have been taken away, his own men want to stone him. He is on his own, but we read he found strength in the Lord his God. How does he do it? We're not told exactly. But I imagine he reminds himself of the character of God, the faithfulness of God, and the promises of God. This is how you find strength in God. You think about his promises. You remind yourself that he has never failed one of those promises. You lay hold of the scriptures and you read, never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. In that situation that you face today, the Lord comes alongside you and says, I've not forsaken you. I've not forgotten you. You're not off my radar. You're right there in the very center. You're the apple of my eye. I know you. I know your situation, just as he knew Paul's situation. And Paul received from the Lord that encouragement that spurred him on to stay for 18 months in Corinth. The Lord is with us. He has promised to be with us. He is with us when we do not know where to go. He will guide. The Lord is with us when we're at the end of our tether and feel our weakness. He is there to guide us. The Lord is with us constantly. The Lord is even there with us when we fail him. Think of the Apostle Peter. You know, don't turn to it, but in Matthew 26 and verse 32, just before Jesus tells Peter that he's going to deny him, just before that, the Lord already hints at his restoration. Because he says, when I'm risen, I'm going to go ahead of you to Galilee. And what happens in Galilee after the resurrection? Feed my sheep. Care for my lambs. Feed my sheep. Even before the Lord tells him he's going to fail, the Lord is knowing full well that God is with us even when we fail him. He restores my soul. God's encouragement comes through his promises. So we've seen God's encouragement coming through his people, through his promises, and then thirdly, God's encouragement comes through his providence. Verse 12. At first reading, verse 12 seems to contradict what the Lord has just promised. While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews of Corinth made a united attack on Paul and brought him to the place of judgment. Hadn't the Lord just promised, no one will attack you? Well, the promise was literally, no one will lay hold of you in order to harm you. They're not going to harm you. Comes pretty close. They lay hold of Paul. They bring him to Gallio, the proconsul. They march him off there. They want to stop him preaching and teaching. Incidentally, we know a fair bit from extra-biblical sources about Gallio, this proconsul, and this is one of the firm date markers in the book of Acts, because Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, this large and important area of Greece. He was the proconsul from AD 51 to 52. So we know that this was less than 20 years after the death of Jesus. So, the charge that the Jews bring against Paul is this. He was seeking to persuade the people to worship God in ways contrary to the law. It was clearly a Jewish issue. It wasn't persuading the people to worship the gods. So this is not about the Greek gods. This is about worshiping God in ways contrary to the law of Moses. They don't say Moses, but later on Gallio speaks about your own law. Verse 15. Now, the Jews know that the Roman officials do not like disturbances. After all, what had the emperor just done because of the disturbances amongst the Jews in Rome? He'd expelled them all. The Romans wanted to keep the peace. But the Jews also knew that their religion was allowed. After all these cities, many of them had their own synagogue. You can't go putting buildings up if you're not allowed to practice your religion. No, the Jews were allowed to practice their religion. But here was something new, Christianity. Here was something divisive. And so the Jews, they come to Galilee hoping that Rome is going to outlaw Christianity, or at least punish Paul, drive him away, and stop him teaching the people this new way. And this is quite an important point in the story of the early church. In fact, there are some people who regard the whole of the book of Acts as essentially a defense of Christianity in the face of the Roman Empire. I don't go along completely with that, but nonetheless, it's certainly here. So what is Gallio, the proconsul, going to do? Well, he doesn't even want to hear the case. Paul doesn't even have to speak in his defense. Let me read verses 14 to 16. Just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to them, "If you Jews were making a complaint about some misdemeanor or serious crime, it would be reasonable for me to listen to you. But since it involves questions about words and names and your own law, settle the matter yourselves. I will not be a judge of such things." So he drove them off. This is quite remarkable. Quite remarkable. Remember, Philippi, Paul thrown into prison. Remember, first missionary journey, Lystra, stoned and left for dead. Here in Corinth, the wicked big city of Corinth, Gallio, this important official, proconsul of the whole of Achaia, refuses to condemn Christianity. He doesn't even need Paul to speak. The case is thrown out of court. And not only that, the crowd turns against Sosthenes, verse 17. Evidently, there was a new leader of the synagogue after Crispus had become a Christian. So they thought, well, we can't have a Christian leading our synagogue. So they must have appointed Sosthenes. And it's not altogether clear who is attacking Sosthenes. Probably an anti-Semitic attack. The Jews have come and a crowd gathers and Gallio throws them out of court. And there was a fair bit of anti-Semitic feeling in the Roman Empire. And so probably a Gentile crowd attacking Sosthenes. We don't know if this is the same Sosthenes who is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 1. If it is, then evidently Sosthenes later became a believer. Be that as it may, what is clear and what is important is that the Roman authorities refuse to condemn Christianity. Christians were not troublemakers. They were not lawbreakers. They submit to authorities. And Paul makes this point in Romans 13 and verse 5. He also says in Romans 13 how God is the one who has established all the authorities that exist. And Paul, we've seen already, was ready to make use of his Roman citizenship in Philippi. After he's thrown and beaten, thrown into prison and beaten, he says, well, should you be doing this to a Roman citizen? We'll see later on in Jerusalem, he does the same. He claims his Roman citizenship. You see, in God's providence, God has given Paul yet another way to help him and encourage him in his ministry. And it even comes through a pagan government official. God's encouragement comes through his providence. Paul must have left that place thinking, wow, God really is with me. And have there not been countless accounts of missionaries thinking they were going to be thrown out of the country, but instead they've had permission? Of course, there are times when they're thrown out of the country. There are times when Paul is thrown into prison. But here, the Lord who had promised to be with him, to give him success, even overrules when it comes to this Roman official. You know, it's easy for us to overlook the providences of God in our own lives and in our own country. Let us thank God for the freedom that we have to live our lives as Christians, to bring up our children as Christians, to teach and preach and evangelize as Christians. It is a wonderful privilege that is not true for everyone in the world. It is God's providence, and we need to thank him. You know, we can even have gift aid. You know, for every, correct me if my figures are wrong, but every pound you give to the church or to any charity, you get another 25 pence back or whatever it is. So it is, yes. It's amazing, isn't it? I can remember when I worked at Woody Road, I calculated on one occasion that my salary and expenses were paid for entirely by gift aid. I wasn't the only pastor. Astonishing, isn't it? And you think of that across the country, that the amount of Christian work that can happen because in God's providence we have a government that is favourable to charities. In God's providence we also have a legal system, we have an NHS, we have education, we have transport, we have shops that are full. You know, you go to the shop to buy bread and the shelves are not empty. This is God's providence. We benefit from these things. Let us be encouraged by it and thank God that he encourages us through his providence. God's encouragement comes in so many ways. If you come to church this morning feeling discouraged, feeling your weakness, feeling the burdens of life, and I think at this time of year, I've often thought this is the busy term of the year, isn't it? End of November. You think, oh, all the work for Christmas to come. And we're way down. God comes with his encouragement. It comes through his people. Isn't it wonderful to just press the pause button on the busyness of life on the Lord's Day and to meet with his people? Isn't that a wonderful thing? You don't have to rush off to work. In God's providence, you still don't have to work on Sundays. Some people do, you know, if you're a police officer. God's providence, his kindness. We have one another. We draw strength through God, through one another. God's encouragement comes through his promises. He has promised to be with you, even when you fail, to restore you. And his encouragement comes through his providence. God sees us in our weakness. God gives us help in our time of need. You remember that children's song, that line? They are weak, but he is strong. You have no need to be discouraged or defeated. You might be exhausted, but you do not need to be discouraged or defeated. Discouragement and defeat are not the work of God in your life. God doesn't bring discouragement. God doesn't cause you to be defeated. They're not God's work in you. God is the one who gives strength to the weary. God is the one who renews our souls, restores us. So let's just pause for 2 or 3 minutes and let's thank him, draw from him, and then I'll pray. Mm-hmm.